Thank you, Doreen. Yeah, so it's great to be at Perimeter again. And I would like to speak mainly about muon physics, but actually about two observables, about the muon decay in orbit and the spectrum of energy spectrum of electrons producing this decay, but also about an observable related to the electron. And the common theme is that both of them are somewhat motivated by the persisting discrepancy between experiment and theory in muon G minus 2. So here we have another G factor, but we'll see that more than this, it may eventually help resolve that puzzle. And another common feature of these processes or observables is that radiative corrections in bound states are much less well known than for free particles, and in fact even one loop corrections in both cases are either still work in progress or a relatively recent development. So as Doug mentioned, there is a number of new experiments coming up in muon physics. There are three main players: Paul Scherrer Institute in Switzerland, Fermilab, and JPARC in Japan. And in black are ongoing or old experiments. So PSI became famous recently in the last 10 years through this discrepancy in the spectrum of muonic hydrogen and different value of the proton radius. We'll hear much more about this in Gil's talk after lunch. But that development motivates a new muon proton scattering experiment that will be done at PSI. And the G minus 2 discrepancy motivates these two experiments, new incarnation of the Brookhaven experiment in Fermilab, and a completely different approach to the muon G minus 2 in Japan. There's much smaller scale, kind of a tabletop experiment. And to serve both of them, there is also a muonium spectroscopy experiment that determines certain observables that is a needed input. The remaining four experiments are lepton flavor violation processes, conversion, these three experiments, and mu to 3e. So I will, when I speak about the muon decay in orbit, it will be mainly related to these muon conversion experiments. But let me step back and mention this historical now motivation. So there is this approximately 3.5 sigma discrepancy excess of measured G minus 2 in Brookhaven experiment over the standard model prediction at the level of about 3 times 10 to minus 9. So, and remember that this A, so G minus 2 over 2, starts at 10 to minus 3. So it is about 3 parts per million. And it is a very large effect if we compare it to other observables. The current best limit on possible new physics contributions to dipole moments comes from this mu to e gamma, so we can express it not in terms of the branching ratio, but in terms of a possible dipole moment, transition dipole moment, that could cause something that is just below the current limit. And you see that it is at the level of a few times 10 to minus 27 electric charge times centimeter, comparable with the best limit on the electric dipole moment, that is nominally even smaller, but because this involves a muon, so a heavier particle, its reach in terms of new physics mass is higher. So mu to e gamma leads the pack. And muon G minus 2 is several orders of magnitude removed from this. It's a huge effect, million times larger. Of course, it is supposed to be larger because there are fewer symmetry violations in muon G minus 2, but these are the CP and flavor symmetries are characteristics of the standard model and are not generally expected to be present similar suppressions in new physics. So this really is suspiciously large, and it is very important to check it. And
Andre,
yes.
Can you interpret the theoretical uncertainty in the G minus two?
Yes. Yeah, so
situation. I mean, what does the theoretical uncertainty mean when you, in terms of sigma? Like you say, it's three.
Yes.
Six sigma.
Yes. Yeah, so
it
is.
Meaning?
Yeah, it is of course a philosophical question, but to some extent yes, because as you know, this most of this error in theory comes from experimental input in the form of vacuum polarization of hadronic cross section. So that has a sigma that comes from experiment. So we can blame the whole uncertainty at present on experimenters. But experimenters are coming to help us in a different way. There is the electron G minus 2 measurement program at Harvard and moving to Andre Institution that is kind of being wasted at present to determine the fine structure constant, where it is potentially sensitive to the same new physics as the muon G minus 2. It is still a little bit less precise in terms of the reach in new physics, but not by much. In the long term, the crucial bottleneck is an independent source of alpha. And I would like to comment in this talk about various possibilities in the long run of determining alpha. To match the current G minus 2 of the muon new physics sensitivity, we need alpha square, or so square of the fine structure constant, with precision of 14 times 10 to minus 11. And so it's kind of a benchmark that we can compare other ingredients. And at present, the best determination of alpha comes from the electron G minus 2. But the second best determination is possible from spectroscopy from the Rydberg constant. And that comes from So this particular combination of fundamental constants comes from hydrogen spectroscopy. And again, Gil will probably mention more of hydrogen spectroscopy, but in a nutshell, we always need at present at least two transitions to determine the Rydberg constant and to determine the sensitivity to the proton radius. So Rydberg constant is this exceptionally well-known combination, but it involves not only alpha, but also less precisely known ratio of the electron mass to the Planck constant. And if we can unpack this a little bit, determine alpha square in terms of Rydberg constant and introduce new constants here. So this ratio of the electron mass to Planck constant is hard to determine directly, but we can determine ratio of the electron mass to the atomic mass unit, so 1/12 of the carbon atom mass, and measure some other atom, for example, rubidium in atomic units, and then finally find the ratio of the rubidium atom mass to the Planck constant. And at present, these first three factors are already known with sufficient precision, but this is still the missing ingredient that is still missing approximately an order of magnitude, less than a factor of 10. And work is being continued. This is roughly the idea of this measurement, that one scatters a photon on a rubidium atom, the rubidium atom absorbs the photon, starts moving to the right, and then re-emits a photon and starts moving even faster to the right. So now we know that of course, this photon now has almost the same energy. It just backscattered off something very heavy, but has lost a little bit of the energy. And that little bit is sensitive to this ratio of the mass of the atom to Planck constant. So one measures this difference in frequencies, and this gives the second best determination of alpha through this chain of products. And we will see later that this factor here, the ratio of the electron mass in atomic units, comes from the electron G minus 2 when an electron is bound in an ion. So that it needs also theory input. But let's leave that for a moment and let's see at different ways of looking for new physics with muons that can that are also to a large extent motivated by G minus 2, because similar loops, like for example this W loop here, but with a muon in the external state replaced by an electron, are responsible for a new process, this muon electron conversion, in the field of the nucleus or quarks. And as Doug mentioned, it is present already in the standard model because of neutrino masses. So such a loop, for example, generates this conversion, but at a very tiny branching ratio. So in practice, at the level of current experiments, we are only sensitive to possible new physics, for example, flavor of diagonal couplings of the Higgs boson. And conversion is theoretically very attractive, very strongly motivated, because unlike the muon G minus 2, it is sensitive not only to so-called dipole interactions, so kind of sigma mu nu type of interaction, but also to gamma mu type of interactions or scalar interactions. Because there is no external photon, so no restriction coming from gauge symmetry. Now, we've just heard that there are some really fantastic prospects in reaching very high sensitivity in these experiments in Japan and in Fermilab. But there is this issue of background. And one possible source of background is the normal muon decay in orbit. So we have this muon is bound in this stopping target that is made of aluminum, at least in the first round of these experiments. And it is possible that the muon decays into a highly energetic electron and exchanges a photon with the nucleus to balance the three momentum. And in that case, the neutrino-antineutrino pair can be very soft. So if we look at the spectrum of the muon decay, for a free muon, the spectrum ends here abruptly at half the muon mass. The reason for this is that the other half, at least the other half of the energy, has to go to the neutrino-antineutrino pair because of momentum conservation. So if we imagine muon decaying in isolation without this nucleus, the three momentum of the neutrinos is exactly the same as the three momentum of the electron. And this three momentum of the electron has a range almost from zero to some limit, approximately at most half of the muon mass. But in the presence of the nucleus, the three momentum can go to the nucleus. The nucleus is extremely heavy, so it takes almost no energy. And then the electron can recoil with almost the full muon mass, except for some tiny binding energy. This is very suppressed. This is still kind of just a perturbation on the spectrum. Nevertheless, it is what mathematicians call a singular perturbation. It qualitatively changes the spectrum from this half of the range. It doubles the range of possible energy without changing the lifetime of the muon much. It's interesting. So the spectrum range doubles, the lifetime almost does not change. There is just a redistribution of this energy spectrum. And the sensitivity of these experiments is so high that even this spectrum that almost goes to zero already here and is further suppressed by five powers of this remaining energy here, so very close to this endpoint, it is really vanishingly small, it is still a considerable background for these future experiments. Now, this distortion by the binding has already been observed at TRIUMPH in the twist experiment. And so I would like to mention how these radiative corrections are computed in this region. And then the physics of this high energy region is very different. Unfortunately, one cannot use the same approach, and they have to be calculated with some new methods. So I'll talk about these two regions, starting with the low energy, or the kind of the main part, accessible also to the free muon decay. Let me talk about this first. We call this the shape function region for reasons that I will explain in a second. So the reason for this distortion of the spectrum is mainly the simple Doppler smearing by the motion of the muon. So the muon is moving with a typical velocity of charge of this nucleus times alpha, times the speed of light. So it's a, like in hydrogen, for example, the typical velocity of the electron is just alpha. But it can be moving much faster if it is closer to the nucleus. So there is some probability distribution that it is in various regions around this nucleus, and there is a region where it is moving fast, and then the electron gets a significant boost, and then while coming out of the potential well, it is slowed down again. So in total, the two effects, this Doppler smearing and the Coulomb attraction, almost exactly cancel, and in the rate we have no corrections of order alpha. There are only corrections of order alpha square, which mirror the relativistic correction. This is just the velocity square. So this is the correction due to the time dilation. The muon lives longer because it is moving, and so therefore its decay width is reduced. It's the simple time dilation effect. Now, in the spectrum, there is no such cancellation, and there are actually effects at various powers of alpha, including some non-perturbative effects that go like exponential of inverse alpha, and are, as we saw in the spectrum, are 100% near the endpoint of the free muon spectrum. Now, there is a formalism developed already twice in QCD, 20 and about 10 years ago, first in the context of deep inelastic scattering and then in the context of B quark decays. And now we reuse it again in QED, and there is this function that is related to the muon wave function in momentum space that in QCD it cannot be computed analytically, but in QED we can compute it and have a nice simple formula. In QCD it is just a certain non-perturbative object, somewhat abstract. Here, this is the beauty of working in QED, that we have, in principle, everything explicit. So excuse me? Yes?
And so it's very nice that you can compute the theories. You mentioned there are also these non-perturbative contributions. Can we compute these here as well?
Well, this is non-perturbative. This is not an expansion in alpha. Yes, this comes from the solution of the Schrödinger equation with the Coulomb potential. And if you remember the spectrum that ends here at half the muon mass, this spectrum goes to zero due to this smearing. So it goes somewhat like this. And we have a 100% correction here.
But in QCD, people in PDKs, they use these shape functions, but then people also were sometimes discussing, sort of, they said, well, this is like resumming the OP, but then they said, well, it still relies on the OP, and there might be additional corrections which are simply not captured by this.
Okay, so, well, here it's a perfect laboratory, especially that there are data, and the benefit of using this formalism is that we do not have to calculate radiative corrections in this region anew. We can convolute free muon decay, which is now known to two loops in the spectrum. Frank Petriello contributed to this determination for the free muon, and we convolute those results with the smearing and get this spectrum corrected by radiative corrections. in almost in the full range up to possible new phenomena at the very low energy, and approximately up to here, but not beyond. So in this, in the high energy region, we have to, unfortunately, we do not have this. This high energy region is not explained just by the motion of the muon in the bound state. Oh, here is we can see this agreement of the red corrected spectrum with twist data. So we see those black dots that clearly prefer the radiatively corrected spectrum from the, respectively, the free spectrum and corrected by binding effects by without radiative corrections. Now, let me explain. So if you could just please remember for a couple of slides, and I will explain it in the following slide, that this part of the high energy spectrum is suppressed by 5 powers of Z alpha and also by 5 powers of this remaining energy. So we have maximum energy at the endpoint, approximately equal to the muon mass. And if we look at the probability of finding an electron with some lower energy, we have this, let's say, delta, this difference of the maximum to this energy in fifth power, and these 5 powers of Z alpha. So very strong suppression factors. But it turns out that the physics very near the endpoint is very simple. We can consider it as a free muon that decays after exchanging just a single hard photon, very highly virtual photon, with the nucleus. So this single photon has virtuality of approximately 100 MeV, mass of the muon, minus 100 MeV squared. So purely 3 momentum, no energy. No energy because the nucleus almost does not move as a result. So it does not absorb any energy. And off comes an electron now with boosted correspondingly by this momentum transfer to the nucleus. And in the meantime, somewhere, muon decayed, emitted its neutrino, anti-neutrino pair and became an electron. So very unlike the low energy region, we do not have to resum this ladder of Coulomb photons that leads to the shape function. It is sufficient to exchange a single photon, and we have the leading effect at the endpoint. Why just one? Because these are hard photons, not potential photons. So exchange of each such photon costs a factor of Z alpha. If we had another such photon, for example, split this momentum between 2 photons, we would have another factor of Z alpha. So it's a subleading correction. And these subleading corrections are, of course, they are important in this region, and we would love in the long term to match, so have an interpolating function that matches these radiative corrections to this part, to the shape function. But it's a non-trivial task, and nobody really knows how to do it at present. But we are trying to move in that direction by including more photons here.
So where do you get the z to the fifth?
So z to the fifth comes. Let's count. We have 1 z alpha, sure, from this exchange squared, because it is the matrix element squared, so 2 powers. And this only, because of the high virtuality, it happens very close to the nucleus. So we have 3 powers of Z alpha coming from the wave function at the origin, that the muon is close to the nucleus. And the 5 powers of the energy difference come from partially from the phase space and partially from the matrix element, from these neutrino momenta, which are soft. So each of them carries 1 power of each neutrino momentum goes like 1 power of E max minus E. And yes, we can now expand this spectrum to around the endpoint in three small parameters, this remaining energy, Z alpha, and alpha over pi that determines how many radiative corrections we include here. And we have just done the first one, so just one loop. But it's relatively new. Yes, this was not known before for a bound muon. For free muon, up to two and partially to three or loops are known, and in the bound muon, all this work has yet to be done.
Just a quick question. You were talking about this photon coming off, and that's suppressed by a factor of Z alpha. There's no suppression of additional delta over some hard scale associated with that photon exchange?
No, it is just purely perturbative. Okay. Yes, and it is actually, since nothing had been done before, it is, one can idealize this, for example, this nucleus as just point-like, structureless, and this becomes a very clean, very well-defined theoretical problem. Just like the free muon decay, but with this twist, that there is this external field. And so there is kind of a whole research program that one can develop here.
And this is the soft, how you treat soft, additional soft
division,
or what is that?
And yes, and now we have both virtual and real correction. So there is also a modification of this decay spectrum by soft photon and real photon emissions, and there is the standard soft photon factor that we reproduce here, and it gives the bulk of the correction. So we find that there is actually not exactly Z alpha to the fifth, but this five is modified and becomes five plus approximately 10 alpha over pi. So these soft photons give an additional suppression and actually reduce the background. Experimenters say that this is a very rare case that theories did something that actually helps them. Because their background is even.
How big is the delta in practice?
Yes. So,
this is defined just as this difference, but for the experimental, it's
yes.
The value.
Yeah. So the delta, optimistically, they say that it will be on the order of 100 kV.
I mean, okay.
Yes. Their energy resolution, of course, scaled by the muon mass.
Just right.
So,
and you read some is leading logs by exponentiating this, but there would be subleading logs.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So that remains to be done.
I don't know whether how big these subleading logs would be or not.
Yeah, so you see that if we take this energy bin to be 100 keV, the reduction is by 16%. If we take it by as 1 MeV, it is. This is just the leading log suppression. So probably subleading is on the percent level.
How accurately is this delta E to the fifth spectrum known? Is there a large uncertainty on the shape?
There is, of course. Thank you. There are, of course, higher powers and logs of. There are also Z alpha. Delta to the sixth log delta corrections, for example. So the distortion from this fifth power is fairly strong.
That can it be calculated?
It can, in principle, yes. Yeah, it's work in progress still.
I mean, the experiments will be interpreted based on the shape of that.
Yes. This is, of course, what motivates us, that we believe that these experiments will not immediately discover conversion, so instead they will actually map this spectrum very precisely. Probably will be a couple of PhD theses.
So actually, can I ask one question? So would this really help? Because you're also folding in some efficiencies and things like that, which you probably don't know that well. So you're measuring the shape is this thing that's hard to calculate together with something that you don't know. So this means that you're probably going to just have to fit the thing with some phenomenological function. And then just use that to get the conversion bound. So the question is, how well would you know the efficiencies around the endpoint? Because as you know, for the mu-to-e experiment, they're completely blind to low energy electrons. And then they start seeing them at some energy, but there must be some efficiency factor.
Right, and also a resolution function.
Correct,
shape
yeah,
of
that's
the,
right, yeah.
Of the signal, but they all might only expect to see a few events. So in their interpretation, they will very much need to rely on this expected shape, and whether or not what they observe deviates from that expected shape.
Right,
so it's very important.
But they will have a lot of data at slightly below the endpoint, because again, you know, they're aiming at this 10 to minus 16 sensitivity level, so they're getting at the
at least.
But if you start going down just a little bit, then this is going like something to the fifth power.
Yeah.
So you're going to see, you know, thousands or...
But they can make measurements by turning the magnetic field down or...
Correct.
Right, to look at the lower energy region to validate this theory below the peak. But the question is, how well is this shape known at the peak region?
Will be known by 2021. Okay, so I would like to move on to this other observable, to the magnetic moment of a bound electron. So just like the muon spectrum is modified by the binding, also the magnetic interaction of the electron is modified by the binding, by this Coulomb field. To first order, of course, G is equal to 2, but is modified both by self-interaction of the electron and modified by the external Coulomb field. And it is useful because, as we will see, it serves to determine the electron mass, and in future, it may serve to determine alpha. And therefore, and also the theory of this effect is important because there is an analogous theory affecting hyperfine splitting in muonium that I mentioned, that this complementary spectroscopic experiment needed for interpreting G minus 2 of the muon. And again, this is a new laboratory for determining quantum effects in an external field. There has been a lot of work has been done for large Z numerically with exact Coulomb propagators, but we are trying to do a complementary work where these numerical methods actually, somewhat ironically, they do not work well for simple atoms. They work well for highly charged because of certain conversion issues, certain convergence issues. So the context for this is the measurement of the electron mass in a Penning trap. And we see here the electron is this little thing bound to a nucleus. In this case, it is a five-fold ionized carbon, so hydrogen-like carbon. And it sits in a Penning trap in the combined magnetic and electric field. The reason why one does not work with a free electron is that this, although cryogenic, it is done in a finite temperature, so there is some thermal motion of this trapped object, and in case of the electron, at a given temperature, it translates into sufficiently high velocity, even at cryogenic temperature, that there is this relativistic effect on the mass that distorts the mass measurement. So these are really very highly precise determinations. If we anchor it to the ion moves proportionally slower, proportionally by its mass, at a given temperature. The electron actually moves much faster than just due to temperature because it is now bound in a Coulomb system. But the difference is that we know a lot more about this quantum motion than about thermal motion. And then the two frequencies are measured, the Larmor frequency, precession of this spin, and the cyclotron frequency of this whole object. So these are very precisely measured frequencies. They are proportional to the G factor, the spin precession frequency. And in the combination of the two measured frequencies, the sensitivity to the magnetic field is eliminated. And one gets the electron mass in terms of the ion mass. So for carbon, this is basically the atomic mass unit. We get this ratio in terms of this ratio of frequencies. up to this G factor, which is only approximately equal to 2, and we need these binding corrections. By the way, there is a separate line of experiments measuring the time dependence of this ratio, because these masses have very different origins. Carbon nucleus comes primarily from QCD, and the electron mass from the Higgs. So if there is any time evolution of time variation of fundamental constants, these two masses are expected to evolve differently, and the ratio could change. So back to this interesting complication, how is this G factor modified? So in the lowest order, without any self-interactions, an exercise in relativistic quantum mechanics, perturbation theory, we take the ground state of the hydrogen-like atom, we know these wave functions, and calculate the magnetic interaction as the perturbation, and one finds that there is this proportionality factor G in this shift of the energy in the magnetic field, and G can be expressed exactly in all orders in the charge of this nucleus with which the electron is interacting. We get this non-perturbative result. This was actually obtained already in 1928, when Dirac equation itself was very fresh. So one of the first applications of the Dirac equation by Gregory Bright. And we see that there is this significant dependence of this correction on Z alpha. Well, by the way, when Z alpha is 0, of course we reproduce G equal to 2. But there is this significant correction, and for large nuclei, like uranium, for example, hydrogen like uranium is experimentally accessible, this is close to 1, and we see that the G factor is reduced by approximately 30%. So very strong dependence on alpha, and can be exploited to determine alpha. But I'll mention this a little bit later. For now, let me show you how this G factor is further expanded. So we have a double expansion, really. One is in the binding effects, and the other is in the number of self-interaction loops. So we take not only the electron in the Coulomb field, but also self-interacting. And again, it is not a trivial task, and this even one loop. Okay, so there is part of the binding correction is universal. It's always Z alpha to the 6, starting with one loop, two loops, and every, five loops are known for a free electron. We know that the leading binding correction is this Z alpha square over 6. But beyond this, the corrections continue to various powers, all powers of Z alpha and logarithms of Z alpha. And this leading one-loop correction was only computed around the year 2000 by Krzysztof Pachucki and his collaborators. And then I joined them to compute these two-loop corrections, and we found these coefficients of this first non-universal term. We found that they are analytically the logarithmic correction, and this is only known numerically. And for a long time, we thought we knew it exactly, and recently we had to shift it a little bit. But I'll explain this in a second. But when these corrections were obtained, and this was more or less overlapped with new experiments in mines that measure these pending trap frequencies, that improved the electron mass by about a factor of 3 compared to previous measurements in Seattle, the University of Washington, where that worked with a free electron. And then, relatively recently, 3 years ago, a new electron mass was determined, so new incarnation of these pending trap experiments, and they now approximately match the theoretical accuracy and are kind of seem to be getting momentum and are on track to improve this further. So we are trying to find the Z alpha to the 5th correction. That's now the front line. But as a byproduct, we revised this constant here, and it comes from an interesting phenomenon, namely there is an previously overlooked light-by-light scattering contribution, where this external so we have an electron in the field of the nucleus, and the magnetic field does not couple to the electron directly, but only through some virtual electron loop, and we can there is a certain momentum region in these loops where we can contract it to a point, and there is such a new interaction of the electron, either with Coulomb field and the magnetic field, or with two Coulomb fields. So this gives this additional light-by-light contribution and shifts a little bit the electron mass. And there was also last year some controversy about the virtual muon effects of somewhat similar origin that's also now under good control. But interestingly, one can also couple this additional photon again to the nucleus, so two Coulomb fields, and this turns out to be again a previously overlooked contribution to the lamp shift. Just so without any interaction with the external fields, just with the nucleus, and
what runs in the loop again?
An electron. Yes, that's the dominant effect, or anything, but the heavier stuff will be suppressed. Now, previously people, of course, examined this, but only in the limit when all these loops are hard, and there is now this additional contribution where this loop is soft, so just these are contracted to a point, and we have this electric field. Two powers of the electric field. If you remember, the electric field in the atom goes like 1 over r square. And we have an effect here that is proportional to the square of the electric field. And computed with the wave function that can be taken as the constant. But altogether, we get actually a divergent integral, and it turns out that it is a logarithmically enhanced correction. So there are other diagrams that also give logs that are completely not calculable at present, that have just an addition. They have a hard three loops here and an additional Coulomb photon in parallel to this whole thing. They would cancel this divergence and complete this logarithm. But we can already now deduce the coefficient of the log.
Go to the previous slide. So there's also just a simple box diagram with a blue photon exchange. So is that, it's not the same order? I lost the counting of orders here.
That's this one, right?
Can I again just exchange the photon directly with the nucleus
from
another one over there? So I don't need to go through this loop here. I'm just trying to think about the counting in.
You bypass by one photon.
Yes, of course,
there is such a contribution too. This one goes back to Feynman, I think, 1956.
One of the issues, you know, in ionic hydrogen is these type of, box diagrams, especially because this nucleus is off shell.
Oh, you are talking about an even simpler one without any fermion loops.
Yeah, the trying to think.
Polarization of the nucleus.
Right.
Here we are not worrying about the nuclear structure. This is all kind of the leading nuclear order with a point-like nucleus.
Can you go back to your diagrams where you were just showing the expansion alpha? This is just the first set of diagrams that you showed.
This?
No, one more. Yeah, this one. So you mentioned this contribution from the heavy muon briefly. I'm wondering, do you care about vacuum polarization diagrams where you exchange either muon or some hadronic stuff where you might be sensitive to hadronic physics, or is it just too suppressed by 1 over heavy masses?
It is suppressed by masses, but I believe that Savelli, Karschenbaum, and Simon Eidelman computed them for the G factor too. They are very small, but they are known. But one thing I wanted to advertise is that you see, this is a three-loop correction. And usually in the business of, say, collider physics, these are relatively exotic effects, small. But here, we find that this one overlooked contribution shifts 1s to 2s transition in hydrogen by about 280 hertz. And the experimental error is 10 hertz. So this three-loop correction is about 28 times the experimental sigma. But it does not solve the proton radius puzzle, because it only affects this one, this most precise transition, 1s to 2s, and not the other one that is needed to reduce the proton radius. It is just a very small shift. Okay, so in the my last two slides about exploiting this bound G to determine alpha. So remember that this is this Gregory Bright 1928 observation that G is modified by the binding with Z alpha square as the leading contribution. So Vladimir Shabayev in St. Petersburg came up with an idea that this can be used to determine alpha, but of course when you see a lead nucleus, there is a natural question, so what about this lead nucleus? Well, the nice thing about these highly charged ions is that one can form various, one can kind of model all the whole periodic table ionizing one heavy nucleus, one heavy atom. So we can have hydrogen, or we can have boron, like lead, and there is one combination of the G factors in hydrogen and boron, like lead, where the leading nuclear uncertainty cancels. Now, this for a moment looked very promising, but now alpha, because of progress in G minus of the electron, is so well known that this would not be competitive. But there is a next generation of this idea of looking at hydrogen-like and lithium-like ions with one type of a nucleus and then with a different type of nucleus. So a combination of four measurements where not only the nuclear structure cancels to a better precision, but amazingly, one can cancel the whole sensitivity to the free electron G minus 2. So in principle, such measurements can bypass much of the theory of the free electron. So these Kinoshita results, heroic, of course, and very important at present for determination of alpha, may in the long run not be important. And in principle, this would be an avenue of determining alpha with a higher precision. Yes, because there is no problems with these five-loop contributions. So theorists will not, it's not that theorists will be unemployed, they will just have to switch to computing not for a free electron, but for an electron bound in a lithium-like ion, and we are still busy with hydrogen-like ions, so this is really a daunting task because we don't know the wave function analytically, and one has to combine the theoretical formulas with the variational calculation of the wave function. But it's nice that we will be needed for a while. So this brings me to the conclusion. You see that basically the bottom line is that I think we are on good track for the upcoming conversion experiments, and that it is much more interesting to work with these binding effects than with free particles. There is just a lot of, it's a richer area. Thank you.
Use
titanium or gold, yes. So we've been focusing on aluminum. Aluminum is especially is much nicer for us than, say, gold or even titanium, because Z alpha is still a perturbative parameter. It's just 10%. So we can, this expansion in Z alpha makes sense. For heavier nuclei, we are hoping to team up with Shabayev's people to do calculations with these exact Coulomb propagators. They will have to be done numerically. So it will be a complementary line of work.
Any feeling for the size of the effect at the upper end for, as a Z dependence? Like, is it better for aluminum than it is for titanium, or the other way around? The absolute magnitude of the...
I really haven't thought at all about heavier nuclei, so, but we'll think about it.
Yes.
Do you mind showing the definition of the shape function?
Yes.
What goes into the solution and maybe to contrast it with QCD? I mean, with E-physics.
Yeah, so this shape function here is closely related to the wave function in the momentum space. So X would play the role of a scaled momentum of the muon, and
so it's the widest form.
Sorry, say again.
Widest form.
I think it's just solving, right? Yeah. Solving everything.
But the one in B-physics somehow, I remember, different. I think it looks more like the space. It starts at zero, and then there's sort of a peak, and then there's just a long tail, while yours is somehow completely symmetric. So it really looks quite different. But then they're not 100% sure whether your X is the same. In B-physics, it's this residual energy, the argument.
But,
someone writes the... the momentum is mv dot v plus some residual, and then v dot this residual is omega, and then one plots it as a function of this omega, and it looks quite asymmetric.
Yes, here there is an argument that it has to be symmetric because of this missing operator. Remember that this asymmetry would give a lower order correction that is guaranteed to vanish by, I think, Luke's theorem or something like that. Maybe it's a difference in convention, likely, but the symmetry property is for sure there in this convention in B-physics, because we were comparing with those theorems that were proved in B-physics.
Yeah, we also have, I mean, there are perturbative results in QCD as well, so that if you take moments or things like this, and for sure.
But once again, this formula here comes from this non-perturbative consideration, so...
Yes, but if you take a moment of this non-perturbative function, the moment is perturbative if you integrate over a sufficient region.
That's,
so you can have
that's
some
okay, great.
Information about this, and this you one could compare.
It's very interesting, okay.
Well, point-wise,
look at the exact definition, I think, and then
yes,
you know,
so
exactly
certainly
the function looks like.
It's not the same variable, but it should be the same matrix element.
Would be very interesting to compare the moments. Yes, great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.